I'm not sure what people imagined when they gave me this topic. I don't mean me personally, but what did they have in mind? Did they have the picture of hiring a detective and saying, here's $100, follow my wife everywhere she goes. I'm pretty sure that she's having an affair. And so, of course, he goes out there and, you know, has his video cam in here and keeps following her when she meets the kids at the base of the softball little league and goes, meets her friends and has coffee and salad at some place. And he just follows her everywhere because that way you can affair-proof your marriage. Or maybe somehow you take the minivan that the family owns and put one of those cameras on there, security cameras, and follow miles and miles of boring footage of her picking up the kids and dropping them off and doing all this other stuff for that aha moment when she finds this person and in the sweet embrace. What does it mean? 7 steps to affair-proofing your marriage. I don't know. Can you picture her embracing some man that's not you, gentlemen, and then 3 or 4 of these Secret Service guys take him down, wham, and cuff him. Is that how you affair-proof your marriage? My tongue is in my cheek at this stage because what I'm trying to suggest is that obviously what we're thinking of is how we behave in such a way to help our marriages be strong so that they won't do that. Now, I'm going to do a couple of things in this talk, and I would beg your indulgence in them. One of them is I will be direct in some places. I will not be smutty or glib about things that are very serious, but I will be direct. Number two, there's a couple of places where it might sound like I'm saying something that I'm not. So I want you to hang in with me and I'll alert you there. And then we'll say, okay, here it is. This is one of those places. And let me try to be very, very clear indeed at that point. Let's start with Matthew 19:9. But we're not going to go the same place that is we often go when we do this. Matthew 19:9. This is what the ESV says. And I say to you that whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. I don't want to go into a long discussion of marriage, divorce, and remarriage at this juncture. What I want to do is to say something that is apparently assumed in the statement of Jesus. And can I try it this way? There are many reasons, our speaker just a few moments ago suggested this, many reasons why a marriage might break up. Politics. Election year next year, one's a Democrat, one's a Republican, you can see. Arguments, somebody has a temper, irreconcilable differences. You could, religion, you know, you could lay out all kinds of reasons why a marriage might, at least in a legal sense, be broken up. Interesting to me that Jesus acknowledges that when it comes to adultery, that for some reason that mars and harms a relationship in a way that nothing else does. Now, I know as I say this that I'm looking out over a room where somebody has experienced this. Perhaps your parents or perhaps you yourself. And I'm not being in the judgmental mode at this point. All I'm doing is I'm suggesting, don't we all know this at some level? That what we're saying is that the one reason you can honorably walk away from a marriage is when your spouse cheated on you because the human heart just cannot bear that for the most part. Now, I've been preaching for 35 years. I've been doing it in Africa and in the United States. I have many, many times had a couple walk into my office and sit down in tears because something like this has happened. And sometimes, let's say, the wronged person will say, I still love him. I can live with him. I will forgive him. And she'll find out, perhaps 6 months later, she'll come back to my office and say, I feel so guilty. I know I told you that I could forgive him. I just cannot. One woman said that every time we embrace or begin to touch each other as husband and wife, I see the other woman. That was 8 or 9 months after she had said she could forgive him. I don't blame her. She thought she could do it. But adultery simply destroys, mars a relationship in a way that nothing else can. And I think the Bible acknowledges that. In every other case, it looks to me as if what we ought to be saying is, let's sit down, let's work this out, let's do what we can. Now, I know there is such a thing as a person who has forgiven indeed that other person, and they've lived the rest of their lives together. And that's astonishing, that's miraculous. I'm glad that it works out that way, but I think even Jesus acknowledges this. Now, what I want to do for the next couple of moments is do these seven things, and I'll try to give you the list as I do this. Here we are. Number one. Understand the progressive nature of sexual sin. Understand the progressive nature of sexual sin. What I'd like to do is to go back to the Old Testament and think about David for just a moment. As I read this text, I want all of you to begin to look at the verbs that are used of David's action. I don't know. No, that's not a screen I can write on. I could, but it's not advisable. we'll just note this as I read it. 2 Samuel 11, beginning with verse 2, going through verse 5. 2 Samuel 11, verses 2 through 5. It happened late one afternoon, we read, when David rose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's palace, that he saw. That's my first verb. S-A-W. He saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. I am appreciative of older translations that say, and behold, she was very beautiful. Because I look at that and say, what happened? He saw. But you know, there could be a situation, perhaps an accidental one, where you're keeping guests in the house or something like that, and you open up the wrong door, and you see something, and you say, oh, whoops. Close the door and say, oh, man, I'm so embarrassed. But notice that this was more than just the light rays reaching David's eyes and going to his brain. It says, and she was very beautiful. This is David's thinking. He looks at her and admires her. It's a prolonged look. It is a lustful look, if we can use that term. So we begin with this. He saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? Now, my second verb is inquired. What do you do when you make an inquiry? Now, perhaps we could look at this and ask a different question. What was the inquiry? Can you tell? I mean, it's right there in the text. He asks about her. What was the question? Let's read between the lines, in a sense. Is she married? Okay, who is she and is she married? Is she spoken for? Some enchanted evening, you'll be at a get-together with lots and lots of other people, and you'll look across the room and see the woman that rings your bell. And you walk across and in your best deep James Bond voice, and trying to sound suave as you can, you say, hello, my name is Bob, or whatever the name is. And she says, hello, my name is Mary. I would like you to meet my husband. What do you do? You walk away. Right? Now, we look at this and it says he inquired and they give the information he needs. She is spoken for. Notice the third verb. So David sent, that's verb number three, the messengers and took her. Number three, and then finally, of course, and she came to him and the fourth verb, he lay with her. Now, I'm looking at that and saying that this is a progression of sin in a sense. Are you following what I'm suggesting? You might say, no, Brother Mitchell, it's a regression. Okay, I understand. But you see, what has happened is that he saw her, and then he asked about her, and then he sent for her, and then finally, he commits that sin. Now, if I can do an analogy, a number of years ago, I was working in California as a volunteer in a woman's shelter. You know, abused women, abused children, that kind of thing. And it was my job to talk to men who had abused their partner, is the politically correct term. Some were married, some were undocumented. But we had these men that were sitting there, and I remember so clearly, I would have in front of me the police record. You know, one of those file, manila file folders. And I'd be looking at the pictures and the report of the police and all of that. And I'd say to the man, there's 8 or 10 or 12 other men there, okay, what happened? And he says, well, you know, we were arguing, and then stuff happened, and then I tried to calm her down, so I held her by the arms, and I'm saying, and she ended up two stories below your bedroom on a car, and I have a picture here of her with two black eyes and a broken arm. Is that all that happened? Okay, and he says, well, okay, and here I want to express compassion for the gentleman that I'm referring to, because what you do is you say, okay, can you remember what happened just before you pushed her? He says, okay, this is what was happening. We were yelling at the tops of our voices and I grabbed her. Okay, that's good. What were you yelling about? Oh, she was saying, why can't you make money like my sister's husband, who's a lawyer and makes, you know, hundreds of thousands a year? I understand that. What happened right before that? Oh, we were talking about her shopping spree that she had just taken and used the credit card and maxed out. Okay, now what happened before that? And you see what I'm trying to do is to say, next time all of this happens, please note the steps, the regression that goes from the initial conversation and the steps that warn you. And what I want you to do is to picture it like signs flipping up in front of you before you do that final act, which is to grab her and shove her out the window of the bedroom. Now, I come back to David's story. You see, what you've got here is David who didn't see the signs. The signs were jumping up in front of him. He did not suddenly find himself in bed with this woman. There was a progression that led to that. Now, you say, why is this important, Brother Mitchell? And I guess what I'd like to say on this point is that most of the time when I have sat down and spoken to a heartbroken couple because of this particular situation, and as they've both cried because of what has happened, one of the things that they will say is, before I knew it, I was in over my head. And I take them seriously. I'm not suggesting that they weren't. Or they will say, before we knew what was happening, it was like going down a slide, one of them said, a slippery slide, and there we were doing what we shouldn't have done. And I'm saying, I believe you. These emotions are powerful. I speak to usually young adults at Fried Hardman, age 18 to 22, and they can hardly believe that somebody my age still has hormones. They're not raging, but they're hormones. And I suppose, and you know this, don't you? Because you guys are, most of you are not 18 to 22 either. I don't mean to be disrespectful. And most of you know people who have succumbed. And isn't it a fair thing to say that a man in his 40s or 50s or 60s could be flattered into a relationship by some young woman, right? Or as the Texans like to say, some young thing. All right. Now, if you would, please look at Matthew 5:21. I'm going to look at two texts in Matthew, and this is one of those places where I'll ask you to please listen to me very carefully indeed. But notice Matthew 5:21 and 22, which is not about our subject, but it has a contribution to it. Jesus says here, you have heard that was said of those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment, and whoever says to him, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. Now, notice the principle. He says, you've heard that it was said, don't be angry, don't murder. But Jesus says, and I tell you, don't be angry. Now, if I drew a picture on this up here, I would do something like this, a tree. Maybe it's an oak tree. Beautiful trees in Florida. Enjoyed driving up and seeing that. But picture a tree with its branches spread out. Let's say it's a big one. Let's say it's 60, 70 feet tall. Maybe it's 70, 80 feet broad. How deep are the roots? Just as deep as it is tall and just as broad. Now, what I'm suggesting here, what Jesus is suggesting here, is the way to stop the murder is to stop the motive that precedes the murder, the roots, if you please. Does that make sense? Pull the tree out by its roots. I lived a little bit in West Texas. Practically nothing grows in West Texas in the way of trees. But there's one thing that does. It's the Dutch elm. The Dutch elm can grow right next to your house, and those roots go down and just lift the house up if you'll let it. You can't kill the thing. So what you need to do is not cut it out at ground level, but pull the roots out. So, you know what's coming, don't you? In Matthew 5, 27 and 28, Jesus says more or less the same thing, except about the subject of sexual immorality. Matthew 5, 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, a couple of years ago, I had a woman burst into my office and say, I just caught my husband. You can almost anticipate what she's going to say next, right? He was on the internet and he was watching porn. And so he was committing adultery in his heart, and I can so divorce him now. I thought she was rather eager to divorce him at that point. Now, here's where I need to be very, very careful and very, very clear. Can I be clear? Let me be clear, and here it is. Is it wrong to watch porn on the internet or from any other source? It is wrong. Is it sinful? It is sinful. But Jesus isn't saying exactly what she said it was saying. What he is saying is, if you will cut the roots of lustful thoughts out of your mind and heart, you can avoid adultery. Now, that is useful information, it seems to me. Somebody says, I'm around this woman all the time. It's kind of on my mind. I'm starting to think about her way too much. I'm thinking about what she's like or what she must be like or something like that. And my suggestion is, long before the adultery, long before David lays with Bathsheba, there are steps prior to that. Get out of that situation, right? So what we're doing here is saying, after all, what is the most sensual and powerful force on a human being there is? The imagination. Thoughts. Lustful thoughts. And I'm here to tell you that most men, and I don't know if I can speak for women as well, but most men cannot live in an atmosphere continually of sensuality. And you mean what? You know what I mean by that. Lustful thoughts, lustful reading, lustful television, lustful internet, lustful interactions with other people at work or socially, and it not affect him. Men, you cannot do it. And if you say to me you are, you're like King Pharaoh, in denial. Okay? You cannot do that. I cannot. So don't put yourself in that situation. Cut the tree out by its roots. Now, in a number of sessions with married couples, I said, who are in trouble, I've been impressed with the number of times they suggested they were in over their heads. And I want to tell you guys, when you feel the water lapping at your ankles and at your waist, get out of the water. I just had this image of Mrs. Potiphar. Now, where did that boy go? Holding his coat. Right? Here, let's talk about Joseph for a second. Do you think he was tempted or not? Now, the Bible says, Genesis says that Joseph was well-built and handsome. Right, he was 18 years old, probably in the prime of his life. All right, when the Bible suggests the Hollywood good looks, you know, then you can take it for granted. So, what was she like? Can you imagine 18-year-old Joseph walking into the house and this 78-year-old hag with a pimple on her nose comes up and says, "Come to bed with me, sonny." If you know anything about Satan, you know that he doesn't do that. May I suggest another thing, though I don't know this for sure. My suggestion is that Potiphar was a powerful man. He was captain of the king's guard. What do powerful men in societies like that usually have as a wife? We even have a term for it, don't we? Trophy wife. I reckon Mrs. Potiphar is closer to Joseph's age than Mr. Potiphar. Now do you see it? Now, you remember that it discusses the fact that day after day, she lays it on to him. And finally, there comes a day when nobody's in the house, and the opportunity, motive, is that what the police say, right? And she says, "Come to bed with me," and Joseph grabs his coat, and Joseph leaves and runs. I think he's this close to doing something he knows not to do. Right? Now, he may be a little different from David because he's a slave and he must be in the house and, you know, doing his work, whereas David is master of his own destiny. But still, you can see how powerful these emotions are. So I'm suggesting if you didn't see the warning signs flap up and you find yourself, I go back to David. David could have stopped at number one. "Oh, she's beautiful. Oh, stop it, David." Or he could have inquired about her. "Oh, she is spoken for. Ooh, stop, David." Or he could have sent for her and she came and he might have looked up and said, "Young lady, I'm sorry, this is so wrong, go home." Theoretically, he could have, though that would have been quite hard, I suppose. And that's what we're trying to suggest. Number one, understand the progressive nature of sexual sin. Number two, remember that people sin because it is, at least in short term, pleasurable. People sin because it's fun. I know you say, "I can't believe a preacher just said that." But let's be grown up about this. Are there ever times that you think to yourself, "It'd be really nice if I just did this"? I picture that annoying person, I just walk across and pop him in the nose. For a few moments, that would be therapeutic. It would be dead wrong, but it would be therapeutic, right? Or perhaps you're driving down the freeway and somebody cuts in front of you and you speed up and go past him and slam on the brakes and show him what he just did to you. Now, that would be therapeutic. You'd say, man, that made me feel so good, until, of course, the policeman pulls you over, perhaps. But my suggestion is that people sin because it's pleasurable, at least initially. Now, certainly what the temptation doesn't do is say, this is what will happen down the road and around the corner. It doesn't do that. But what it does do is it says, here it is, laid on for you. Notice, if you would, Hebrews 11, verses 24 and 25. Moses did not do this, as this text says. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. Please note, the Bible even says that sin is pleasurable. It also adds it's fleeting. But both of those are important. It might seem strange, you see, for a preacher to admit this. But I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't admit it. Maybe I should tell you that sin is pleasurable so you're not shocked, stunned, surprised when that opportunity arises and the possibilities come before your eyes. Genesis 3 and verse 6. Genesis 3 verse 6. So when the woman saw that the tree had rotten fruit falling off with worms in it. Is that what it said? That was the RSV. That's the Revised Stan version. Okay. You do know what she saw, right? The woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desired to make one wise. Please note that Satan did not tempt Eve with ugly fruit, distasteful fruit, right? Sin is usually wrapped up in a very attractive package. Proverbs 5, verses 3 and 4. Now, I wish I could read the entirety of that Proverbs section on the wanton woman or the forbidden woman, depending on the translation that's there. But I want you to see what he is certainly saying here. Proverbs 5, 3 and 4. For the lips of the forbidden woman drip honey. Now, do you suppose she actually took some of that lip ice stuff and it was honey flavor and put it on her mouth? No, of course not. The drip honey refers to the seductive, promising words that she uses. The lips of the woman, of a forbidden woman, drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Notice that there's an obvious and immediate pleasure, the sin, her promises, her words. But then there's also, down the road, the consequences of sin. You see, her lips were beautiful, her words were enticing, and when he followed those words, he ran into a buzzsaw. He found out what she was really like. So, please understand that the pleasures of sin are temporary, though they are pleasurable. Number three, men, I'm referring to male of the species. Be understanding of your wife. You know where I'm getting this. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. Find 2 Peter, go back one. 1 Peter 3 verse 7. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to her as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. Please note, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way. I know that men will throw their hands up in the air and say, who could understand that woman? Now, I can tell you about my marriage. Every time I do something, my wife will come up and say, I know why you did that. And she'll tell me, and she's right. On the other side, when she does something, she surprises me every time. I had no idea she was going to do that next. But now, I look at this. Live with her in an understanding way does not mean you can fathom the depths of a woman's thinking. What it means is be understanding in your behavior. Be thoughtful in your behavior towards her. Now, showing her honor as the weaker vessel. I remember we were not married yet, my wife and I. We were watching a movie, and it was one of the scary movies. I don't know why. She loves them, and it terrifies her at the same time. And about 20 minutes into it, she grabbed my hand. It was a sort of interlocking thing. I was pretty happy to have her hold my hand at that stage. It was a confirmation of what I hoped she might feel about me. So we're holding hands, and there's two or three other scary things, and she goes, ee! And woo! And there was one particular time, I don't even remember, but something happened that scared me. And she went, yow! Because I'd squeezed her hand with her little fingers in there. And her statement to me was, you don't know your strength. Well, I don't know if you think I'm a powerful person, but that was, 28 years ago and 28 pounds ago, all right? And my suggestion is, men, that we need to understand that they're different, and we like them to be different. I get worried when my wife can beat me up in a boxing ring, okay? I'm supposed to be the stronger of the two, but then I also need to be understanding of her and her ways. Number four, women, ladies, your turn. I'm picking up with Ephesians 5:33, but the title here is Show Some Respect to Your Husband. Show some respect to your husband. Ephesians 5:33 says, however, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she... And it's interesting. What would Paul have said? See that she... What does a wife do? What would you think he would say? See that she respects her husband. Now, ladies, before you say, oh dear, this is an old preacher doing a male chauvinistic thing. No, it's not about that. Here it is. You've heard the saying, the way to a man's heart is not through his stomach. It's through his ego. And the men are glad I said that, even if they don't admit it. And women, you have in your delicate little hands his ego. You can be the woman to die for. Or you could cut him out regularly at the knees. My suggestion is the best thing is when he's got his buddies in the living room watching a ball game, open the door with stuff in your hair and a bathrobe and all of that and say, hey, what's wrong with you, you dummy? You haven't mowed the lawn, fixed the gutter, whatever it is. Right there in front of his buddies. Oh, yeah, that'll make him like you. Right? Or going to church and going around and telling other people things that probably, perhaps you should tell a counselor or tell him, but you're telling other people. And all I'm trying to suggest here is that there is something inimitable in a man, a male, that blossoms when respected by the woman he loves. And that dies on the vine when disdained and mocked. Men, you don't have to amen me. You know I'm right. Proverbs 31, verse 23. Proverbs 31, 23. Her husband is known in the gates where he sits among the elders of the land. It's implied that he is a leader in the gates of the city precisely because of her. She has made him a better person, more respected. Everything you could think of. Now I look at this and I say to myself, here is the husband beaten down at work and sliced and diced by the competition. And then he comes home and that woman builds him right back up. Ladies, you'll be glad you did it this way, by the way. Number five. Sorry, fellows, you'll have to romance her again. And again, and again, and again. Let me try to describe it this way, and this is one of those places where I wanted to be careful, and I'm looking across mostly, pretty much in its entirety. You know the term foreplay, right? Foreplay begins long before the bedroom. Foreplay begins last night when you came home from work with your hand behind your back. Okay? Foreplay is in the morning when you men wake up and grab her like one of those corny romance movies and bend her back and kiss her goodbye. Foreplay begins when you phone her sometime during the day and say, I was just thinking about you. Or you text her and put some goofy, poetic thing on there. That's when foreplay begins. Foreplay begins when you come back home and you come right off the freeway and you come into the house and you're not in a stinking bad mood, man. And you have something else thought before. What I'm trying to say is you see, let me try and put it differently. Probably the most wildly successful magazine that ever existed was and is Playboy. And you know why. Do you know that they tried Playgirl? It was a financial failure. I'm not saying that the ladies don't look at the physical aspects of somebody else, but ladies don't get excited at a perfect stranger quite the way men do. All right? That's why all the skin was being showed. Now, I come back to this. Think about Song of Solomon, chapter 4, beginning with verse 1. Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verse 1. Now, I need to explain something. Sex in the Bible is neither Victorian nor smutty. Okay? The Bible is direct without making... let me make an observation about humor in our society. Anymore, the sitcoms and the stand-up comedians don't know a pun if it would hit them on the head. Don't know a play on words if it would trip them up and they fell flat on their face. But they do know how to do sexual innuendo. Would that not be the primary method? All right, so I go back to this and say, but the Bible doesn't do that. It's not smutty, nor is it Victorian. Now, Song of Solomon 4, man, take notes. This is good stuff. Girls like this. Much of it. Behold, you are beautiful, my love, he begins. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Good start, man. Write it down and act like you came up with it yourself. So far, so good, commenting on her eyes, her beauty, that's a good thing. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. I think you should probably stop comparisons when comparisons with livestock begin. Don't go there. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one of them has lost its young. Apparently, it was a good thing in ancient Israel, 1,000 years before Christ, if a woman had no missing teeth. Sometimes it's considered that way here in our society too. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like the haws of a pomegranate. This is all good. Behind your veil, your neck is like a tower of David built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warrior. Okay, again, stop the comparisons when you're comparing her to masonry. That's not good. However, read Song of Solomon, man. I should add, did you know that the Jews would not let anybody read Song of Solomon until they were 30 years of age? That tells you what the Jews thought it was about, right? Okay, now, Song of Solomon 8, verses 6 and 7. I have done this for a number of weddings because young couples requested it. It's something that they know about. Set me as a seal, he begins. Where? On your heart. As a seal upon your arm, for love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. It flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered love all the wealth of his house, he would utterly be despised. Get that in a modern English translation so she doesn't recognize it, and write it on a card. She'll think it's great. Okay, man, you're going to have to win her, is what I'm saying. Treat her like a lady. Hey, do those ridiculously old-fashioned things that we used to do. Open the door, even if you got the beeper, beep, beep, you know. No, just go around and open the door for her in the car. Open the door of the house or the restaurant or wherever it is you're going. When she starts to struggle out of this, reach out your hand and pull the two sides of her coat off, right? Never do women jokes in her presence or with her friends or your friends. Romance her. Number 6, I'm checking on the time here. Not too bad. Number 6, make friends with your spouse. Ephesians 5, 15 and 16. Ephesians 5, 15 and 16. Look carefully how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, making the best use of time because the days are evil. What is he suggesting? Make good use of time. Now, I know what it's like. In this economy, when there is palpable hurt out there, men are doing 3 jobs and women 2, just to make the money they made 10 years ago with 2 jobs. right? It's tough. And we're all frazzled and we're all busy. I sit there and students come in and they have their heartbreaks or they need premarital counseling or just a question about the class that I taught and something perhaps that was said that still puzzles them. I'm there all the time. But you know, you have got to carve out time where you and your wife are friends and you can do things together. It can be a dinner. For us, Friday night is sacred. I'm sorry, kids. It's 5 o'clock. I'm gone. I always tell them, I'm famous for it at Freed. I walk out saying, I hope to meet an exotic redheaded woman tonight. She's redheaded, tall, slender, and she talks funny. Well, the kids kind of smile, you know. Sometimes we turn up at the same restaurant in Jackson, Tennessee, perhaps, as a couple of students, and I make the joke, oh, boy, that's what kids want. They want their teacher to turn up at the place that they're having a date, right? And the kids say, oh, Brother Mitchell, we're glad to see you and your wife out there doing stuff together. Make friends with your wife. I remember a time a couple of years ago, my daughter was in the back seat, and my wife and I were in the front. We were talking. My wife and I talk, maybe 45 minutes about some things. Finally, Tracy says, Mom, Dad, could you stop talking about people I don't know? What they did tell me was that my wife and I still talk the way friends do. Right? We were actually talking about people in Africa that she didn't know, in the same way that we did. Make friends with your spouse. Confide in him or her. I said a moment ago a couple of things about sexual immorality and how, particularly for the man, the thing that drives him crazy is the thought of another man with his wife. It's the physical betrayal frequently that gets him. But on the other hand, the woman says, in what ways did he confide to that other woman? What secrets that should have been told to me were given to that other woman? And I'm looking at this and saying, that's why you have a friend known as your wife. I know it's perhaps been said before, but men and women, if you find yourself in a situation with another person that's not your spouse, and you say to yourself, oh dear, I probably shouldn't tell my wife or my husband about this, ask yourself, why is that? You should be with your friend. Spending that time over the dinner table or even at McDonald's. That's one of those great oxymorons, food at McDonald's, right? But if you're with your friend, your spouse, that's where you should be. Number 7, you didn't think I'd finish this, did you? Ensure that you share profound spiritual values. Ensure that you share profound spiritual values. There must be 1,000 verses I could read. I shall turn, though, to Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 through 8. Or 6 through 9, Deuteronomy 6, verse 6. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. Now, I want to pause and say something. What was the phrase directly preceding the one that says, you shall teach them diligently to your children? What was that phrase? There's a phrase that precedes it. Before you teach your children, what? It says, are you there? Anybody? The words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them to your children. You cannot convey something to somebody else that you do not feel yourself. You certainly cannot fool a kid who's been in your home for 18 years, but that's not within my purview at this point. What I am trying to say is what he's saying is God's ways, God's words, a commitment to God, a commitment to everything to do with God needs to be in our hearts first. You know, kids that get married thinking that that'll solve all their problems, don't you? And you know that that made them worse, don't you? I was somewhat amused to find out how many elders want their young preacher, the one that's trying out, to be married. And I'm saying, that has to be the worst reason in the planet to get married. Will you marry me? I won't get a preaching job unless somebody does. Don't do that. The most many times immature people get married for the wrong reasons. But look at this again. These words that I command you shall be on your heart. Then it says you should teach them diligently to your children. That's another person's talk another place. Talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hands and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Now look at that and say, okay, I know he's talking primarily to the way that you convey these things to children, but guys, is it reasonable to suggest that you'll be unspiritual and ungodly and uncommitted in a church, and then this instant you get children, you suddenly infuse your home with spirituality through and through. I don't think so. This needs to have already been a part of you. You and your spouse need to understand these things. And please look at these ideas when you lie down, when you rise, all the time. Bind them as a sign on your hand, on your frontlets between your eyes. Write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. I don't know. Can we have Bibles in the house and godly magazines? Can we have CDs of good a cappella music available in the house? Can we, when we get into the car, have the Bible on CD, to slip in there to give the old country music a break or whatever it is Floridians listen to? Can we infuse our own hearts, you and your spouse, with what is spiritual? Can you have a daily Bible time together? Or if not, and sometimes we make the mistake saying, okay, if you don't do 7 times a week, then you're failures. Don't do that. Just say, can we do it 4 times a week? Or 3 times? Sit down and study the Bible and pray together. Do that. Find times and places to do that. Now, here is where the preaching comes. If you have not sought God and His righteousness first, you don't understand this point. You're saying, big deal. We're both, and here I know I'm going to be in trouble somewhere, somehow, we're both Gator fans. And isn't that enough to be having in common? Or is it the other kind? I didn't get a reaction out of you. Okay, what I'm trying to say is, folks, when we talk about things in common, we both like a ball team, we both like walks in the park, we both like a particular kind of music, those are the shallow things. The profoundly deep commitment you have to God is, should be, ought to be the foundational part of your life. And if you don't share that with your spouse, and that's why it stuns me when somebody goes outside the faith, as we say, and marries somebody else, and I say to myself, you don't share the most important thing in your life. Or was it? Was it? And I don't mean to be judgmental. I'm just asking, was it the most important thing? Then you need to enjoy the thrill of sharing it with that other person, too. Sitting down and talking about God's people, the church, and how you can help it. Sitting down and talking about what the Bible says on certain things. Opening the Bible up and studying it together. Praying together. Going to church together. Being that great couple that has made a difference ever since they came to our congregation. Being those people. Because, my friends, and this is where the preaching ends, if He is not the first in your life, you don't have that most important gift to give to the other either. So, would you please allow me to pray? Bless, O Lord, the marriages represented in this room. Allow them, Father, to be able to step over the brambles and the traps and the things that make it so hard for a husband and wife in our society to be faithful. But, Father, help us to do more than that. Help us to lock and bind and shore up this marriage so thoroughly that this would be unthinkable. And that our relationship with You, the one triangle in this relationship that is a good thing and a wholesome thing, that would be the thing that drives our lives and our relationship. And how, Father, help us to know the sweetness of that relationship with You, with each other. We pray it in Jesus' name, our friend and our Savior. Amen.